It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We drop in now on preparations for the Berkey next month. Skiers start at the American Birkebeiner Trailhead in Cable, ski their way through the gorgeous forested landscape, finishing in Hayward's Main Street. It's a treasured ski race started in 1973. Join in with your questions about the Berkey preparations. Your stories welcome 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Popp is executive director of the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation. Ben, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with conditions because we got the massive winter storm that hit Wisconsin and the nation last month. And I'm looking out the window now at rain. What are snow conditions like in northern Wisconsin?
You know, as I like to say, all it does is snow up here in the Northwoods. No, we are really, really fortunate right now to have some amazing early winter conditions. You know, that early snowstorm that we got brought just some heavy, wet snow that was a really great base. And, you know, interestingly enough, we've had some record numbers of skier up here in the Northwoods over this Christmas holiday week because the conditions are just so good. Now, it is creating some issues. It certainly, that heavy, wet snow closed a lot of trails, trees down, and those sorts of things. But now, as it starts to get opened up and we're seeing even more snow coming, thank you for continuing to send it our way. the conditions are just absolutely fabulous for cross-country skiing in northern Wisconsin right now.
When you say a record number of skiers, is that in your trail system? How many are you seeing?
Yeah, and that is in reference to up here on the Berkey Trail. You know, when we look at the trail pass sales, people buying a trail pass to go out and ski both daily and for a year-wise, November and December were record numbers for us. And interestingly enough, a lot of times that's when we start to see sort of these really dedicated skiers, they're training and those sorts of things. This year, it was actually very different. We're seeing a lot of first-time skiers out on the trail, families coming out and trying it. And so that for us is really exciting that, you know, this time early in the year, whether they got a package of skis for Christmas or they pulled them out of the garage and dusted them off, it's really, really exciting to see the growth of the sport taking place.
You know, it's great where you are, but the Berkey brings in people from all over the state and the world. You know, what about the people who have lost snow and are training for the Berkey? How might the lack of snow where they are in other regions affect training for this year's race?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that you mentioned that. You know, skiing has changed a lot in the last decade, actually, as weather and climate continue to change. Less and less people have snow out their backyard. And interestingly enough, if you look in the U.S., cross-country skiing is most popular in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And you would say, well, what in the heck? And it's partly because they have a large population center with snow and a lot of snowmaking venues. You know, the sport, it's great that we have a ton of snow up in northern Wisconsin, and we love having visitors come, which is awesome, but we just don't have a lot of people. And so when we start to think about where are people living in these larger urban areas, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Stevens Point, these areas, if they don't have snow, then people aren't thinking about skiing. They're not going to buy a pair of skis, or they're not going to do an event. And so what we're really starting to see is cross-country skiing is growing in areas where there's infrastructure being placed for machine-made snow. So you look at Delafield in Milwaukee area where Lapham Peak is, or the new Nordic Center in Berrien, Wisconsin, or in Madison. These venues are really starting to do a lot of heavy lifting for people that want to ski because they have this machine-made snow that they're making out on the trails. And I think I often liken it, it's a lot to like trying to teach basketball, you know, and if the gym was only there every other week, well, not a lot of people would want to do it. And it's really hard to get kids engaged. So these snowmaking venues around the state and certainly the country are really starting to make a difference in where people are skiing and who we see out on the trails.
Well, that's interesting. We're talking with Ben Popp, who leads the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation, as we preview this year's American Birkebeiner and talk about cross-country skiing, the state of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, what final preparations need to be completed before Berkey events unfold next month?
Well, you
This
know,
is
it's funny.
crunch time for you.
It really is. It's funny to say that, but you know, I mean, anytime you bring upwards of 45 to 50,000 people to a small community, I mean, you look at Hayward, 2,500 people, Cable, just over 300, you know, and now you're going to bring, you know, upwards again of nearly 50,000 people with spectators and skiers. The infrastructure there is just not there, right? The roads, housing, all those things. So a lot of temporary housing or a lot of temporary infrastructure goes into create an event like this. So it's everything from how do we provide aid and support for the skiers out on the trail to things that sometimes we can't control and we just hope, like crossing Lake Hayward, one of the last, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you start skiing in Cable, Wisconsin, you ski 35 miles through Bayfield County Forest and Sawyer County Forest and end up in Hayward. And the last thing you do is cross Lake Hayward, which is dammed up Nemecogon River. And, you know, of course, we get all this snow and it really acts like a big blanket on the lake. And so one of our biggest fears even already is what does lake ice look like on Lake Hayward? Because that is the last 2 miles that people ski into downtown Hayward to finish the event. So it certainly is a lot of trail preparations, all the way to things like when are the tents going to show up? And again, that temporary infrastructure that really helps host the world right here in northern Wisconsin.
How far do people stay, away from the race, in order to be able to be part of the atmosphere in the Berkey? I mean, where are people coming in from?
You know, that's a really great question. I mean, we see people chartering buses and groups from the Twin Cities. They say, oh, well, it's only 3 hours. Well, we might have to stay 3 hours away anyways. You know, we look at already a lot of foreign athletes that oftentimes register a little bit later, and now we're trying to help them find housing. It's amazing whether it's as far as Superior or Rice Lake or down towards Eau Claire, where you have, start to have some of these larger hotels and whatnot to really support that because, you know, you think about it, every resort, every small hotel, every Airbnb, you name it, is full typically from the year previous. People come, they do the event, they have a great time, they register, and then they sign or they re-up for their housing. And so it ends up that it really is a huge geographical area that people stay. And then more and more, we're finding, like you say, people staying at home and actually chartering buses or chamber of commerces. I know Rice Lake and some of the others do that. They'll actually come together, put all their hotel and say, hey, if you stay at a hotel in beautiful Rice Lake, Wisconsin, we can put you on a charter bus and get you up to the start of the Birkebeiner. So it really is not just a regional thing, but really becomes statewide when we start to look at the impact it has throughout the state.
Ben Popp leads the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation, getting us up to speed on the planning, the preparation for Berkey events set for next month. Join in with your Berkey experience, where you stay, how your family has interacted with this iconic Wisconsin ski race. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on final preparations for the Berkey, North America's largest cross-country ski marathon, set for Saturday, February 25th. Join in with your Birkebeiner questions, reflections on skiing it in the past, how you prepared for the 50K for skate skiers, 55K for classic skiers, 800-642-1234. Ben Popp is executive director of the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation and stays with us. Ben, let's unpack some of these events. Coming up on January 21st, there's a Berkey tour that's open to the public. Can you tell us what this is?
Yeah, the Berkey Tour is kind of a fun event. It started about 15 years ago as a way to really get people out on the trail. It's an untimed event, and so it allows people to come up and ski on the trail. They put out the aid stations so that you can see what it's like to get some support on the trail. And it really, because it's untimed, it's not about go and how fast am I going to do it. It's really about participating with a group of people out enjoying skiing and being active. It really is a fun way to get introduced to me is to ski with a larger group of people and what is it like. And you know, one of the interesting things about skiing, if we look back at the SCORP data from the state, the data that we have to put together to get some from federal funding as a state, we look at everything from what activities do people do, and then we do it across against a bunch of variables like age, race, sex, income, rural, urban, those sorts of things. And interestingly enough, cross-country skiing was the most egalitarian activity. In other words, the activity that most did across all of those variables. And so we start to see skiing is actually done by a lot of different people for a lot of different reasons in the state. And so, you know, you have an event like the Berkemeiner where you come and you race fast and you try really hard, but then you start to see a lot of other events like the Berkey Tour or the Ski to She or some of these events that introduce people in different ways that want to do it for different reasons. And it's really kind of a fun thing to see.
I think that is an entree to the Para Berkey as well on February 22nd, the day before the Berkey. This is an adaptive event for skiers. Can you tell us about this race?
Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing to see some of the para athletes. In fact, one of the para athletes used to be on our staff was just an amazing inspiration. I mean, we think it's hard enough to go out and ski able-bodied, and now to see somebody that's either in a sit ski or they have one arm or whatever their adaptation may be, it is amazing. And so there's a variety of lengths. They start in different places, but everybody finishes in downtown Hayward. And the amazing thing is there's even some of the para athletes that actually do the entire Birkebeiner as well. Now, fathom that, being in a sit ski and some of these huge hills and ups and downs and literally going 35 miles in a sit ski that's only double poling.
Wow.
And really hard. It's just phenomenal. So I would highly recommend, just amazingly inspiring athletes of all ages and abilities. So certainly a really fun entree to the whole weekend of skiing events.
And to kick it off, there's an open track event for skiers, and you call this a relaxed way to experience the track. And I was laughing because what does a relaxed approach to the course really mean?
Right, right. It's sort of, it's almost like we wish we had an e-bike for skis, but not quite that relaxed. It really, so it's similar to the tour in that instead of, you know, some people, they love the energy of standing next to 13,000 other skiers saying go, and you crash down the trail. And, you know, there's everything from snowmobile corner and people cheering as you crash to, you know, the 39K club. And it's really high energy. And so what the open track is, and it's modeled after a lot of our European races that the World Open have, that there's a day or two before that they call it an open track. And everything is exactly the same in terms of the course is set up. There's aid stations. But instead of having everybody say go and you go at the same time, there's actually a window that you're given to be able to leave. So from, let's say, 8 to 8:30 in the morning. So not everybody has to line up and right next to each other. It's really much more relaxed. So you still have to ski the same course. And there's a lot of the same support out there. But you can really do it on your own own time, if you will, in that it's not go now and finish then. It's really spread out and gives people a much more relaxed, if you will, quote unquote, relaxed feeling of skiing the trail, getting supported, but again, not having to have, you know, 13,000 other friends right next to you as you're trying to do it.
Sounds like a lot of these supporting events are also a gateway to whether you feel ready to do the Berkey, because it is a commitment.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're 100% correct. Now, every year we will get a few what we call cold turkey Berkeys. They'll show up from California, Missouri, Florida, and it literally be the first time they put skis on that year, if not sometimes ever. They've heard about it, they want to come. And so that's how we end up literally with people from every state. And but the other events, the people that take a little bit maybe smarter, we'll call it, approach to skiing the Berkey. These other events are really a great gateway to learn about the sport and practice. And interestingly enough, we have the Prince Hokan race, which is 15 kilometers, and the Coeur d'Alepet, which is 29. So they're on the same day, the day before of the Berkey. But what they do is a little bit shorter events. It allows people to get into it, start to learn some of the technique and the enjoyment of being out, but you not have to have that huge commitment. And the exciting part for us is that cross-country skiing for a long time in events has been it's been a male-dominated older demographic. So median age, 50, 51, 65 to 70% male. And what we're starting to see, especially in these gateway events, is 50% men and women, if not more women than men in some of the events, seeing that median age drop. And so for us, it's super exciting to start to see that we're getting more and more young people involved in the sport and/or people that that are new to it. So really exciting to see.
Ben Popp with us, Executive Director of the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation. You can join in on skiing, on whether you've done the Birkie, how you've prepared for it. What goes through your mind as you're out there on those trails? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, let's talk about your volunteer brigade, if you will. You know, how many volunteers do you need? What is that like to keep them? And what role do they have in putting on these events?
Well, it's really interesting that there's nearly 3,000 different volunteer positions that happen during that Birkie week. So even though the Birkie may have a staff of 30, you think, oh, wow, they're putting on an event. No, it's really the entire community that does it. And now to even take a step back further, if you remember when we opened, we were talking about there's 2,500 people in Hayward, another 300 plus in Cable. Well, that does not even alone add up to what it takes to put on the Birkie. So you really start to realize we have volunteers from all over the country. In fact, we have people that show up just like the Birkie skiers coming from. In fact, I was talking to somebody from Seattle just the other day. That is their Birkie experience. They come out, they volunteer all week, and they love it. They just really enjoy the energy, the excitement of helping these people accomplish this huge athletic endeavor. And so when we talk about the event and what it takes to put it on, it absolutely, there's just zero chance that it would happen without the entire community and volunteer base that shows up. And we have what we call these volunteer chiefs that have been involved for 15, 20, 30 plus years that come back year after year. And they're almost like a full-time staff position, believe it or not. Hmm. They take on huge amounts of responsibility. And it's everything from what does the start line look like to how does the finish to running these aid stations, where there's sometimes 60 or 70 volunteers. It's really like them orchestrating an entire, you know, the whole venue. And so it really would not happen if we did not have this huge support of not only the community, but the volunteer base as well.
I wonder about their communication system. Like, is it walkie-talkies or cell phone? What is reliable out there on the trails and supporting these skiers?
Well, that's another really good question that you bring up, because, you know, we're still working on better cell coverage up here. Certainly broadband has been an issue because a lot of the start and finish are connected with it, but not a lot of the intermediate areas. So while we do rely on some two-way communications, some cell coverage, because the other thing that happens is the cell phone might work great today, but suddenly you drop an extra 30 or 40,000 people. The cell networks just are not reliable any longer. They get overwhelmed and the communication really starts to struggle. So what ends up happening is medical brings in a whole separate system so that they can communicate on their own, which is really important, obviously, when things have to be communicated. And then certainly internally, it becomes unbelievably difficult, believe it or not. And a lot of times two-way communication ends up being the best with simple repeating radios and the like, because some of that other infrastructure that you think would work super well and might on a Wednesday in July isn't so reliable, again, when you bring so many people in. And we have a fair amount of preparatory meetings early on, even this period of time, so that ultimately those small groups are able to communicate. But it gets really difficult, believe it or not, once we get to Birkie week and things are rolling. And we often laugh that it's sort of like this huge snowball that starts rolling, and either you get out of the way or you get rolled over. And so it's certainly exciting to see it coming fast.
Also along those lines, in terms of technology and apps and tracking your racer on mobile devices through GPS, how has tracking technology changed, and how are we following these racers?
Yeah, it is pretty amazing, actually. Now with their chips and their bibs and the
chips
information.
Chips in the bibs. Okay.
I know. So they actually have little transponders that go in their bibs. And then all along the course, they have these mats that pick them up. And so you as a spectator, you're able to kind of follow where your little blue dot, your husband, your wife, your loved one, your friend is along the way. And so rather than having to stand out in the cold on Main Street for hours hoping they're going to get there, you can actually figure out when they're going to be there, which is kind of fun. And certainly, I think last year we had well over 100,000 people tracked around the world, tracking those different skiers. So it's sort of also a way that if you can't come to Northern Wisconsin or you can't watch the live stream, you can kind of see how your friends are doing out there. And certainly from a safety standpoint, has really brought an added bonus to the whole event.
And I'm sure that you're gearing up to mark 50 years next year. That must also be on your mind very quickly.
Big time, actually. It's really going to be a big celebration for us. We're really excited. It's gonna be really important to really highlight 50 years. The fact that Ernie St. Germain, one man, has still done every event will be a center point to that. He's an inspiration to so many in within our community, and it's going to be a big deal. We're excited.
Ben, all the best. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Ben Popp is Executive Director of the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a 124-page book that profiles 275 Wisconsin executives doing business in a variety of industries in all corners of our state, like banking, construction, education, healthcare, restaurants, logistics. Call in about Wisconsin business leaders who you think are raising the bar in their sector. It's our view on Wisconsin's C-suites now at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Weiland is editor of BizTimes Milwaukee, oversaw the production of what's called Wisconsin 275. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So people sometimes discredit lists like this, that they think they're biased or that they don't really matter. What do you think?
Well, we think if nothing else, it's our role is to provide information, but also spark debate, spark conversation, raise awareness. And, you know, if people think the list isn't be taken seriously, well, I invite feedback and response. So there's been a tremendous interest in this book that we've put out. We've had a tremendous amount of web traffic of people interested in reading about the people we've put on this list. So all indications are there's a lot of interest in what we've done here. And this is something that an idea that we got from other similar publications in other parts of the country that likewise received a tremendous response. So,
well, take us behind the scenes. How did you put together this list of business leaders?
Yeah. Well, like I said, there were other publications in other parts of the country that have done things like this. So that was where we got the idea from. And we had talked about doing it for years, but we knew it would be a big project. And this year was the year we finally decided to take this on. Other publications have done it. A really good example is Dallas. There's a publication in Dallas called DCEO that does a similar book, but it's only in the Dallas area. And they have 500. They identify the 500 most influential business leaders in the Dallas metro area. We felt that was too many for us. And then we thought something to do it differently for us was to do it statewide. We thought that would be more interesting. And so this is a project that took the better part of a year, really early 2022. We started working on this and we just started researching. We started brainstorming. We started putting together lists of people who we thought should be on the list. We reached out to people around the state, particularly economic development groups in all corners of the state, seeking their suggestions, telling them what we were working on. And we started to build a list, and then we made more specific reach outs to particular individuals in different industries. And so through that process, we then organized the names we had into different categories. We wanted to make sure that we had each, not only each area of the state represented, even though we knew the larger metro areas would have a lot more representation, we wanted to have different industries included. So we wanted to make sure we had some people in agriculture, for example, and not just maybe real estate or banking, some of the more obvious, quote unquote, business areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and then we got down to the hard part of figuring out who to include and who not to include. And once we got to that, then we had to start getting to work on writing these and researching these. And we sent out, when we picked people, we sent each of them a questionnaire to respond to. Some did, some didn't. The ones that did, we were able to include their responses to that questionnaire. And it took until December to finally wrap it up and put it out, print it out, and send it out. So it was a lot of work. It was a big project.
Many steps there. What makes a business leader influential?
Boy, that is a great subjective question, isn't it? You know, certainly we looked for leaders of key companies in key industries. Certainly people at the top of their company and at the top of their industry. But, you know, it's not just the CEO of XYZ company. We looked for people who we knew from our research are making things happen, making key deals, involved in important economic issues and economic projects throughout the state. So there was all kinds of different things that were taken into consideration. But there wasn't any hard and fast criteria for sure.
Talking about what makes an influential business leader in Wisconsin, Andrew Weiland is editor of BizTimes Milwaukee. The publication recently published Wisconsin 275. It's an outline of the state's innovators. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Well, let's zoom in on some people on the list here. One leader is known as the world's most successful caviar entrepreneur by Forbes magazine. Tell us about Bill Holst.
Boy, he's a very interesting person. And just the fact that he was identified, like you said, by Forbes magazine is that tickled our curiosity. And he's quite an entrepreneur. You know, he didn't respond to our questionnaire, so we really had to rely on our research. He's a corn farmer. He owns a scrap yard. He's previously owned quarries. He's in the Hudson area, by the way. So in the kind of Prescott Hudson area. He also owns a number of golf courses, and that's kind of sort of how I first got on our radar, I think, is he purchased the Troy Byrne Golf Club in Hudson. That is, when you look at the rankings of golf courses in the United States, that's actually one of the that makes these big lists.
Mm.
We often see Whistling Straits showing up and mm-hmm. and Erin Hills, you know, the golf courses that have gotten a lot of attention for, you know, hosting major tournaments. Troy Byrne makes those lists up in Hudson, and Bill owns that golf course. So, but then there's also what he's done, you know, in caviar, as you mentioned. He purchased a sturgeon farm in Hungary. He purchased a caviar company in Germany. He is part owner of a caviar company in China. It's a caviar processing company.
And I think that's really interesting because he has this huge caviar production company in China, but he also owns, from what I understand, the caviar competitors in other countries. So really having a kind of a toehold in the industry.
Yeah. I mean, he's a pretty fascinating guy to have just gotten into that area. So that was just because of all that he's done. You know, he's sort of a classic entrepreneur. what a lot of people call in the business world a serial entrepreneur, like someone who just wants to create businesses and get into new things and seeks opportunity and sees opportunity and goes for it, even in an area that maybe it doesn't necessarily know a lot about. It just kind of
He had never
tries to,
tried caviar.
yeah,
Well,
sees the opportunity and gets into it. So just a fascinating person, and that was sort of part of our desire to do a list like this, is to let people know about all these people in the state doing interesting things. A lot of the people in this book are names that are very familiar to people, and oh yeah, a lot of people in the business world know some of these people, but there are some people like Bill Holst, who a lot of people I think do not know about and would be fascinated to know is in our business community in Wisconsin.
Well, with caviar on the table, you asked the group of business leaders who they'd love to have dinner with. What insight did you gain from their answers here?
Oh boy. Well, there were a lot of interesting responses. I think Elon Musk came up a lot. And of course, there was one person who I won't name who actually had said Elon Musk as the person they want to have dinner with. And then they later said, I want to change my answer and I don't want to say Elon Musk. So his was an interesting one that came up. A lot of people are fascinated by a person like that. Warren Buffett is a name that not surprisingly came up a lot. Elon Musk has done a lot of controversial things and made a lot of waves with what he's been doing, especially with Twitter, and says a lot of outrageous things. And at least one person became uncomfortable with that and said, I don't want to say that I want to have dinner with Elon Musk.
Changed
So
their mind.
decided to change their mind on that one. I won't reveal who that was, but.
I want to turn now to another person on the list in the healthcare category, Heather Shimmers. She's been on our program several times, and let's listen to her here in November of 2020 talking about burnout in healthcare workers.
We know our communities are tired, but so are we. And the frontline staff is reaching a point where they are stressed and they are very, very exhausted. They are working long hours. They're covering for their peers because that's what we do in healthcare. We don't get to leave when the work is still there that needs to be done.
So in our conversations with Heather Shimmers, we consistently hear her advocate for healthcare staff who are under her supervision. Why did she make the list?
The biggest reason she made the list is, like I said, we wanted to represent throughout the state, and healthcare is a very important industry. These are huge organizations, huge employers. And what happened recently was that there was a merger between Green Bay-based Belen Health and La Crosse-based Gunderson Health System. And that merger of those two systems created a $2.4 billion system, 11 hospitals, 14,000 employees. So, I mean, this entity affects a lot of people's, not only the lives they're obviously saving and treating, but all the people that work for them and the economic impact that has. So she's part of that. She's now regional president of the Gunderson region for the Gunderson and Belen Health System. So she's kind of part of that Gunderson piece in La Crosse, and we wanted to make sure that that organization was well represented here. We included three people from sort of the Gunderson slash Belen entity, and she was one of them that we felt was important to include.
Andrew Weiland, editor of BizTimes Milwaukee, taking us through their new publication called Wisconsin 275, profiling the most influential business leaders in our state. Colin, about who you think deserves to be on this list and why, or who you wonder if they're on the list. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about Wisconsin 275 in its first publication edition, how BizTimes Media developed their list of the most influential business leaders in our state. Call in with your questions about business executives. Who made the list? Who didn't? Weigh in on the business climate and the C-suites that are based here. 800-642-1234. Andrew Weiland is BizTimes Milwaukee editor, stays with us. So, Andrew, you asked leaders about the state's political environment. What surfaced there?
You know, I think it's not surprising that business leaders in general are overwhelmingly conservative. So that's not a surprise. But what was interesting was when you asked them about the state's political environment, overwhelmingly the response was, I would say, dismay at the division. And, you know, I think what business leaders see, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, is they see a bitterly divided state, you know, so-called purple state, however you want to term it. And especially right now with a Democratic governor and a very Republican entrenched legislature that do not really cooperate very well. I think it's been very clear, you know, the governor tries to call the legislators in the session and they immediately gavel out, you know, whatever the issue is. You know, I think there are business leaders that are frustrated that, you know, the extremes seem to kind of rule the day in both political parties, and that they would like to see cooperation. Business leaders want to see problems solved. And I think a lot of business leaders recognize that there needs to be compromise to solve problems.
I would imagine, too, they also want predictability, especially for regulations and things that they encounter in their own industry.
No question about it. That's absolutely huge. So and sometimes you hear people say divided government is good from a business point of view, because then nothing will get done. So then all that means I can just assume status quo because it'll just be gridlock. So some people in the business world like that sort of situation. But that wasn't really when we asked our Wisconsin 275, when we asked them what they think of the state's political environment, that was not something people said.
Hmm.
What the most common general theme was frustration that there's not cooperation and working together to solve the state's problems.
I want to turn now to some losses in the C-suite. Michelle Goss stepped down as Kohl's CEO last month after holding the position for nearly 5 years. Quick Trip's CEO, president, Donald Zeitlow, retired just days ago. How much turnover have you seen recently in C-suite positions?
Well, you know, there's always a few, and it was an interesting, you know, it's an interesting question as to how we sort of approach that with our list. Michelle Goss leaving Kohl's, we took her off our list because of that.
Ah.
But Don stayed on our list, but obviously he's leaving, and, there's change, there's a change of the guard at Leinenkugel. There's, change happening at, Sartori. Of course we saw some iconic business leaders pass away this year. Unfortunately, of course, you see that happening. That's just a part of life, of course. Herb Kohler and Michael Cudahy were just giants in the state of Wisconsin. And their deaths were deeply felt within the business community. So those are notable losses as well.
The list includes roughly 40 women, and most of the business leaders are white. How did you reconcile creating a list of influential business leaders in sectors that truly lack diversity?
Well, it's a challenge. On the one hand, the list reflects sort of the reality of the business world in Wisconsin, which it has become more diverse, but it still is, especially at the very, very top and of organizations, and these are the people on our list are generally CEO type level. Generally, you know, it's still overwhelmingly male, overwhelmingly white. And nevertheless, we wanted to have as much diversity as possible in the publication. We think that's important, but we also didn't want to pick people just because they're a woman or just because they're a person of color. So we wanted the list to be a true list of the most influential business leaders of the state. So it skewed the way that group is. But nevertheless, in the back of our minds, there always was knowledge of, okay, how many women, how many people of color do we have in this list? We certainly were counting. We certainly were keeping that. We were certainly aware of that. And, you know, sometimes if we're trying to make a decision over who to include and who not to include, that was a factor. That was a factor to try to get, when the opportunity presented itself, more women and more people of color included.
Andrew Weiland is editor of BizTimes Milwaukee as we talk about their new publication, Wisconsin 275. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Just want to bring in another person on the list, Valerie Daniels Carter. Tell us who she is and why she made the list.
She is a fascinating individual who, again, example, another person who we want to include to hope people would get to know more about her. Speaking of diversity, she's an African-American woman in Milwaukee who became one of the largest, her organization is one of the largest female-owned restaurant franchise organizations in the country. And in fact, I think it's the largest female-owned franchise restaurant organization in the country. Started out her career in banking, and she was with a mortgage insurance company. And then her brother is also on the list, you know, John Daniels, really prominent individual, an attorney with Quarles & Brady, chairman emeritus at Quarles & Brady now. Together, they decide to go into the restaurant industry. They built a Burger King restaurant in Milwaukee, and that's how she started her foray. Kind of he assisted her, but she really leads the restaurant. Even though he's still involved, she leads it day to day.
Something to watch there. Andrew, thank you for joining us and introducing us to Wisconsin 275.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Weiland is editor of BizTimes Milwaukee, oversaw the production of Wisconsin 275. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.